Welcome to the Partially Examined Life, episode 119, part 3, on Nietzsche's The Birth of Tragedy. In the previous two parts of this, we painstakingly went through Nietzsche's sort of historical account of how ancient Greek tragedy, like Aeschylus and Sophocles, that is the Antigone play that we just did, grew out of an ideal fusion between the Dionysian and the Apollonian strains, the chaotic and the orderly, the subconscious irrational versus the rational planned. And in part 3, we're going to get to the death of tragedy, how later tragedians like Euripides screwed up this delicate balance, and the way in which they screwed it up is very much reminiscent of what was wrong with Socrates. So, in turn, what was wrong with philosophy as a whole, the modern spirit of science, and we'll talk a little bit about how Nietzsche wants to apply this to his culture and how we can apply this to our culture, though we didn't actually officially assign those parts of the book because Nietzsche later decided that they were terrible. Now, were we done saying how awesome Greek tragedy was, according to Nietzsche, or do folks have a few more quotes that they want to pull out?
Before he moves on to Euripides, the death of tragedy, and Socrates, and sort of laying the knife of the death of tragedy in Socrates' hands in some respect, and then redeeming Socrates by having him dancing, he does talk about Dionysus as the centerpiece of Attic tragedy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I think that that's important because of the emphasis he wants to put on the Dionysian. Even though, as we've been saying over and over again, the Apollinian and Dionysian go hand in hand, that you can't have the tragedy without the Apollinian. Like we said earlier with music, the juice comes from Dionysus. That's the source.
We may have been living in an era, or he thinks that we may have been living in an era that's been cut off from that juice for so long that we're reaching the point where the scientific attitude or a frame of mind is reaching its own limits and reaching back for that, or acknowledging the need for that juice.
And that juice is in a certain sense an affront to the order of things. When he says Dionysus is the protagonist of all tragedy, what he means to say is that something that is an offense against the established order is really what's at the heart of tragedy. And he talks about Prometheus, and Prometheus defies the gods, steals fire, gives it to human beings, which is what enables culture. Human culture starts with an offense against the gods. And for that, Prometheus has to be punished. And that's the trope that he says that tragedy plays out over and over and over again. For something to be born, there has to be an offense against order, against nature, against some kind of law. And simultaneously, that transgression has to be followed by punishment.
So if you look at the second paragraph of section 10, the mystery doctrine of tragedy, the fundamental knowledge of the oneness of everything existent, the conception of individuation as the primal cause of evil, and of art as the joyous hope that the spell of individuation may be broken in augury of restored oneness. So part of the point of the Dionysian is that for aesthetic experience to redeem life, it has to have this element of restoring oneness. But the problem with the whole idea of oneness is the horror of lack of individuation, right, which I mentioned, but also that passage about individuation in the context of incest. And I mentioned during the Antigone episode that the horror of not being individuated is not just about destruction and dying, although it is that, but it's also about going back to the womb, which is, again, why incest is relevant. It's not just, oh, we've picked a taboo. It's directly relevant to this whole idea of oneness and our ambivalence towards that and the way in which art can give us that in a sublimated way.
Well, I think we should follow in the path of the Apollonian in the Socratic eventual outgrowth of tragedy, and we should assert our separateness by kicking John off the call, the non-philosopher, the non-rationalist.
I've really felt like I was getting closer to you guys, and now I'm going to have to get on my ship and sail through the stormy oceans of reality alone. Thanks.
Tell us how you felt about the whole, because you mentioned some of this to me offline, that just how you felt about the reading and all that.
I felt like reading this from section 1 through section 15, it was almost watching him emerge from some sort of cocoon or something. Like the quality of the writing, it's almost like he's shedding an old way of talking about this stuff. And that when he escapes from the all the historical speculation, which is what it feels like to me, or at least it's stuff that he's not willing to back up in any direct way, a lot of those like historical stages. And although maybe it's perfectly spot on and I don't know, but I would have liked to have heard him talk about that in a more grounded way. It's almost like when he gets to that section about tragedy, he's like breaking free of that mode. And all of a sudden, the language and the writing becomes incredibly clear. Wes, when I spoke to you, I was just coming out of that moment where I found it very disappointing and sort of sophomoric in a way that I'm not used to Nietzsche because I've only really read the later stuff. Did anybody else notice that? I'm just curious. Like, there's like a change in the tempo of the whole thing.
I felt like this was as good as it was going to get out of the gate, but definitely there's some more poetic parts in the middle.
Did you just read it in two different sittings, John, and you weren't grumpy in one sitting? And
you got it. Well, then I'll leave you with that. Thanks a lot, guys. And have a. I look forward to hearing the rest of what you talk about, except for Wes.
All right. Well,
thanks, John.
Well, good night.
All right. Good night.
Good night.
Good night.
Okay. So I had just given us something from 10, and section 11 is where we're going to start getting into Euripides and then Socrates.
So we've said a little bit about Euripides already in that he marks a kind of downfall of Attic tragedy, in particular by taking us further from the oneness that comes with the chorus.
So what's his most famous play? Can we just say we read Antigone, but I'm sure a lot of people listening have never heard any other Greek tragedy ever.
For each of these, there's only a few extant plays, so they're all famous. But, you know, you could say the Oresteia or the Bacchae.
Medea is Euripides.
I still wouldn't know the difference.
Who are you asking about? Who are you asking about? Euripides?
Yeah.
Yeah. He's making a big deal about why Euripides sucks compared to Sophocles. And to me, it's like, it's all the same stuff. I probably read some Euripides at some point, but like, I haven't looked into this stuff enough to be able to say.
Well, they feel completely different. If you read them back to back, they feel completely different.
And the whole point of section 11 is he's basically going to say Euripides is a naturalist, right? That's what he's objecting to. And there's a weird combination, and this is part of Nietzsche's point, in Euripides of kind of a sentimentality, like you have very pitiable characters, but also this naturalism where you have characters who will defend themselves with long arguments and the language is more ordinary. I think it's paragraph 4 where he says civil mediocrity is sort of given a voice in Euripides. So, you know, instead of you forgetting about all the regular people sitting next to you in the audience and identifying with the Dionysian chorus, suddenly everyone is just a regular person on stage.
The other thing is, I think he's saying that part of the problem with Euripides is that Euripides actually introduces the notion of a character that you're supposed to be sympathetic to. The Euripidean characters are actually supposed to be tragic for their own personal action, not as archetypes, not as representations of fate. And I thought that was one of the things that he lamented about basically all theater from Euripides to his own present day, was that you were actually supposed to care about individual human beings and sympathize and empathize with them, which is not an action of unity. It's more an individuation.
I mean, he goes on to talk of this cheerfulness of a slave with nothing great to strive for, values nothing that are focused on nothing higher than the present. So this is a version of Greek cheerfulness that Nietzsche doesn't like.
So the connection, and I notice on Wikipedia that Sophocles is only like 17 years older, probably, than Euripides. So we're talking about a pretty quick degeneration on Nietzsche's scale. It's not a matter of two generations later, things start sucking.
No, and Aeschylus saw Sophocles' plays made.
Yeah, they competed against each other. Yeah. And Sophocles started winning. And they're like a generation and a half apart. And then it's just another generation from Sophocles to Euripides.
And my recollection is that Euripides was hugely popular.
So this is kind of like 60s rock was awesome, but by the 80s, man, sucked. It's that kind of scale we're talking about.
Right.
Well, from whose point of view?
He's just talking about the scale, not the time scale.
Yes.
You know, the Fast and the Furious movies are very popular.
And I mean, you know, that's something that Nietzsche kind of alludes to. He says Euripides is basically pandering to the lowest common denominator.
Basically refers to the Fast and the Furious movies. Basically.
Isn't that a Euripidean play?
Well, Vin Diesel's mentioned in section 12, 13, right?
What about Vin Diesel?
I just mentioned in section 13.
All right, we were all trying to make the same joke at the same time.
Sorry. So let's bring Socrates
Who's
back.
Who's pandering now?
So did Socrates help Euripides write his plays? That's what Nietzsche implies.
I think it's important, though, just the last section of 10, where Euripides didn't feel superior to two spectators, to himself as thinker. And then the other one, he doesn't mention him until later, but it will turn out to be Socrates.
That's in 11, right?
It's in the last paragraph of section 11.
Yes. The solution to the above puzzle is this. As a poet, Euripides may very well have felt himself superior to the mass, but not to two of his spectators.
Yep.
What does this mean, that he doesn't feel superior to himself as the thinking person?
It's like writing a play, but you're really more of a critic, and you think about it too much. Instead of letting yourself be inspired or connected to something that's more enigmatic and more gut level, you overthink all of it. And then it's reflected in the deus ex machina and the need for the happy ending and characters to be bailed out and the need for everything to make sense. And then naturalism, where everything has to be very realistic. That's the thinking impulse at work.
Yeah. He says, Euripides sat in the theater with this talent, with all the clarity and agility of his critical thinking, and he had strained every sinew to recognize feature after feature, line after line, in the masterpieces of his predecessors, as if studying paintings darkened by the passage of time. And here he encountered something which can come as no surprise to anyone who's ever been initiated into the deeper secrets of Aeschylean tragedy. He perceived something incommensurable in every feature and every line, a certain deceiving definiteness, and at the same time a puzzling depth, indeed infinity in the background.
Right. And he didn't like it. He did not like that. Yeah.
Yeah. And he didn't like it. I think I should have stopped earlier.
Oh, I think that having a depth thing in there is right on point.
Yeah.
It's infuriating about the whole trend that Nietzsche is representing here to me.
Say more.
You know, if I'm going to judge a work of art, I would like the criteria to be understandable. I'd like them to be communicable. If I don't understand why somebody considers something great, it's just great. Oh, you just don't get it. You're just too much of a Philistine to get it. I'm not happy about that. You know, there has to be some way for me to get my head around it, for it not to just feel like arbitrary taste. And I feel like a lot of people use their arbitrary taste, just like John was referring to, that he thought a lot of what Nietzsche was doing here was basically bullshitting, was basically like pulling his particular aesthetic judgments out and just, you know, universalizing them and writing them into his metaphysics and just all this sort of irresponsible stuff. And I'm not that critical about Nietzsche that way for some reason, in the way that I was about Thoreau and Emerson and other folks we've talked about, just because I like Nietzsche's systematic style, even at this point, that he's really self-critical in a way that I didn't see in those other figures. But regardless, it's still in Nietzsche's own preface that he wrote later to this, that he wrote, you know, around the same time as Genealogy of Morals and some other of this later stuff. He says, you know, this book did not go over because it pitched itself as esoteric, that you're just not going to get this. And specifically.
Well, it didn't go over because it wasn't a work of scholarship, and it's speculative. Yes. Instead of bullshit, I prefer the word speculative. But
but wasn't it popularly a success?
It certainly did not get him a lot of more students. Not only did it piss off his academic colleagues because he wasn't playing their philological game, but it certainly did not help his like attendance rates at his classes and stuff. And I think that was already bad.
He had other professors, though, telling students not to attend his classes.
Yeah, it did get worse as a part of this. But certainly there was no popular uprising that Nietzsche is awesome at this point. He did not become famous until after he was basically insane,
yeah,
right? Until most of his work was out there, even though he had cultivated relationships with people like Wagner. And, you know, so he had a cult following before that.
I'm not going to defend that position, but I think they mentioned something about it. I think they said it was more well received popularly than it was critically. Maybe that was what.
Sure. That wouldn't be too hard if it was savage critically.
So can I get back to this Socratic point, or
the
Euripidean point? All right, so Dylan just read this section where it says, one of these two spectators is Euripides himself, Euripides the thinker, not the poet. And if we go back and think back to section 7, page 41, where he talks about how the Apollonian knowledge that the tragic person gets is wisdom. It's the wisdom of Silenus, and you feel revulsion from it. the transfer is that we're still talking about knowledge when you talk about Euripides and Euripides the Thinker, but it's the knowledge that doesn't feel revulsion at an understanding of the tragic. It's the knowledge that feels that it can overcome that, that knowledge itself is without limits and can correct these things. In other words, that knowledge can overcome the natural state of human beings, can overcome the tragic. So instead of becoming aware and then feeling revulsion and then feeling satisfied, like, oh, you know what, my life is faded and I can't do anything about it, Euripides is the Socratic knowledge of thinking, oh, I understand this, and now because I understand it, I can overcome it.
Right, which means knowledge is the basis of virtue, right?
Exactly, exactly.
That's the optimism that, you know, Nietzsche accuses Euripides and Socrates of. So the optimism is that human beings are perfectible in some way or improvable to the point where we can simply entirely leave the orbit of all these tragic realities. If I just know enough, if I just have enough knowledge, I can become a virtuous human being, and virtuousness just is happiness. That's like a sort of denial of this darker instinctual side, including our murderous impulses and our other terrible impulses. It's just a way of sweeping them under the rug, which in section 12, he says that the tragic effect is basically done away with in Euripides. So where the Apollonian, the epic Apollonian, transforms the most terrible things by the joy in mere appearance and in redemption in mere appearance, the Euripidean play just does away with the terrible in a sense. Is that right? Maybe I'm wrong.
Yeah.
It naturalizes it. It's no longer this unmovable fact of life that can be redeemed aesthetically. It's something we can improve ourselves out of.
That's exactly right. It's the optimistic denial. It's exactly the idea that the world can be justified through knowledge instead of through art. And the only way that that's possible is if you believe that knowledge can heal our ills, that knowledge is a guide to morality in that sense. And he says, I think it's roughly around page 82 of my translation.
So what section?
16.
That's beyond where we were going to read.
Oh, sorry. Never mind.
It's all right.
Well, in this section, I'll tie this back to what we were just talking about. So if you believe that knowledge is limitless and is the basis of morality, that's what kills myth and the tragic. That's when tragedy dies. Euripides represents the Socratization of Greek tragedy. Nietzsche says only when the spirit of science or knowledge without limits is carried to its limit and it actually has to face the fact that its universal validity is negated by these very limits, is there a possibility for there to be a rebirth of tragedy? So that's just a way of tying the so-called affirmative latter section that we didn't read, that I shouldn't really be mentioning.
It's okay.
Back to this discussion.
Just to point us to something in section 12 that is very similar. He's talking about the effects of Socrates. So this section, he's really developing this second part of problem with Euripides as his Socratic tendency. Mm-hmm. And that it becomes no longer Dionysian versus Apollinian, but becoming Dionysian versus Socratic. So the Socratic becomes, at least in this part of it, a kind of special embodiment of the Apollinian. And so he says, we have come to see that Euripides had no success at all in putting drama on to purely Apollinian foundations, and that his non-Dionysian tendency got lost in a naturalistic and unartistic one. We can therefore now get closer to the nature of aesthetic Socratism, whose supreme law runs roughly like this. In order to be beautiful, everything must be reasonable. A sentence formed in parallel to Socrates' dictum that only he who knows is virtuous.
So in Kaufman, it's to be beautiful, it must be intelligible, which I kind of like. And then knowledge is virtue. It's like the truth is beauty kind of thing.
Yeah, I like that too. And the next sentence is good. It says, with this canon in his hand, Euripides measured every single element, language, characters, dramatic construction, choral music, and rectified it in accordance with his principle. What we criticize so frequently as a poetic flaw and a step backward in Euripides' work as compared to Sophoclean tragedy, is mostly the product of that penetrating critical process, that bold application of reason.
So I don't really care if he's being faithful to to whatever the classical philological and whatever classicist interpretations of these things are. I have never liked Euripides as much as I have loved Aeschylus. And I am certainly, despite the fact that I'm involved with you clowns and having done this for 6 years and gotten degrees in philosophy, don't consider myself Socratic in the truest sense of the word, that I believe that knowledge is virtue or that beauty is intelligibility. I don't agree with those things at all. And the Greek play that speaks to me, the Greek tragedy that speaks to me most clearly is Agamemnon. And maybe I shouldn't wax poetic about this, but it is a Greek tragedy of the Attic sense, but it's tied to the Homeric myths in a way where there's the word I guess I'm searching for is pathos or something like that, that there's a sense in which I felt a strong sense of empathy with the characters who were wronged, or speaking particularly about Clytemnestra, but at the same time understand the role that Agamemnon plays and why he had to do the things that he did.
Why he sacrificed his daughter.
Why he sacrificed his daughter and why he was gone for 10 years and why when he comes back he has Cassandra as a captive. And there's a sense in which he's completely oblivious, much like Creon. And when we read Antigone, Creon is completely oblivious to the fact that he's like, I'm the king. The king makes the rules, right? And Antigone's saying, even if you're the king, there are these older, deeper rules. He can't see, I don't want to say mistakes, it's not even the right word. He can't see the consequences of his actions until it's too late. And in Agamemnon, you don't even get the chance to experience Agamemnon as a character like Creon, who's completely blind. He just simply is playing that role. He's been at war for 10 years. He comes back. He has his captive, you know, Cassandra with him. And his wife, who has been waiting and waiting and waiting for him for 10 years, has taken a lover. And she orchestrates this whole thing where she doesn't connive to have him murdered. She actually kills him herself. And then she comes out and defends her actions. And I guess in a weird way, it might be worth an analysis of this to see whether it conforms to Nietzsche's interpretation or definition of Attic tragedy. But this is the one that has always spoken to me.
You describe it in a way that makes it seem like it's appealing because it's more realistic in some funny way, that you have characters that you can sympathize with that feel vivid and real, which is exactly the criticism of Euripides. And I confess that that's the aspect when I read Agamemnon that really resonated with me. But it's also true that there's just way more chorus in Aeschylus than there is in anybody else. And I myself, in you know Nietzsche's sort of criticism and encomium to the power of the chorus, I myself have never found the chorus. I've never been able to sort that out. I don't get how it's acting, and I've always found it kind of a weird institution myself.
You Socratist.
Cretan. Just to bring it to more modern stuff without talking about particulars, I don't see an inherent conflict between having vividly drawn characters that you can identify with and having a strong mythic element that sort of shakes you to your core. And I think that is what any modern fantasy, Game of Thrones, Lord of the Rings, whatever, or even sci-fi or other, you know, what they're basically trying to do. They're trying to give you human elements to hook onto so that even in Antigone, I think you're supposed to be able to sympathize with Antigone or certainly Ismene or some of the other characters. They're not just these Dionysian gods up there that you can only contemplate with awe and be pulled into some non-thinking weird state and affected unconsciously by. No, they relate to ordinary human beings. And I'm not familiar enough with Euripides to know whether I would agree with Nietzsche's particular take on him or your particular Seth apparent dislike of him. But it doesn't seem irrational to me at all to look, when you are starting to write in an art form, to look at the various aspects of it and say, what in this makes sense to me? What actually connects with audiences? What seems just freaking weird and I should get rid of it? Like, that seems an entirely expected way to run.
Well, let me make a distinction between empathizing with an individual character because of how they feel, and so having a feeling of empathy with the unworkable situation that they've been put into. That's the difference that Nietzsche wants to prioritize or lionize Aeschylus and Sophocles, because he thinks their tragedies express unworkable, tragic situations that these archetypes, they're not even individuals. Antigone's a name, but Antigone's just a placeholder. You're not supposed to empathize with Antigone, the character. You're supposed to empathize with the tragic situation that puts her in a position where she has to choose between two things, which both have bad outcomes.
Can I put this in another way?
Yeah.
You don't get to know Antigone enough, as well as you would need to as a character, to empathize with her or identify with her in the way you would, say, reading...
Well, Sophie's Choice.
Someone in a novel or even in a... Yeah, or even in a like a Tennessee Williams play. It's the chorus, in a way, that does a lot of the empathizing. If you look back over Antigone or look at Oedipus, all the emotional stuff is going on with the chorus. And the chorus is trying to call these emotions out of you, regardless of how well-developed the characters are. So to whatever extent you're empathizing with Antigone, I think you're responsive to the chorus and its pathos.
Okay, before we go on, Seth, tell us more about the sponsor for this episode.
Hey, folks. We've been talking to you for a few months now about the Great Courses, and we here at PEL are big fans of the Great Courses, and they've been great about sending us materials to review and share with you. I recently watched the Great Courses lecture series, The Philosopher's Toolkit, How to Be the Most Rational Person in Any Room. Award-winning professor Patrick Grimm provides great tools to help sharpen critical thinking skills, think outside of the box, and be more creative and inventive in our daily lives. Now, I just went back and watched the episode again about game theory, which is really fascinating. He does a great job of explaining the origins of game theory, how game theory differs from decision theory, and discusses a couple variations of the game theory model that go beyond the prisoner's dilemma that you're probably familiar with. This is also the lecture where he makes his case for John von Neumann being the smartest man in the 20th century, which is really fun too. The Great Courses, celebrating their 25th anniversary, has over 500 video and audio lectures taught in many subjects, including philosophy, history, religion, and more. Available in DVDs, CDs, you can stream it, digital downloads, or even use the Great Courses apps. For a limited time, the Great Courses has a special offer for our listeners. You can order from 8 of their best-selling courses, including the Philosopher's Toolkit, at up to 80% off the original price. Now, this offer is only available for a limited time. So order today, go to thegreatcourses.com/PEL. That's thegreatcourses.com/PEL. We thank the Great Courses for their sponsorship of the Partially Examined Life, and thank you for listening.
Okay, thanks, Seth. So we should talk more about Socrates and what he has to do with this.
At the beginning of his discussion of Socrates here, he really hangs the death of tragedy and is kind of weeping over it with respect to Socrates, that Socrates is a kind of philosophical villain until he gets to the end, or the end of what we read, where he brings us back to the Phaedo, where Socrates is writing poetry just before he dies. You know, he points to the music-making Socrates.
And the fact that the Platonic dialogues are played.
Full of myths.
And that Socrates is a daimon.
Yes.
As daemon.
One of the daemon parties, but that's me still being critical of Socrates, because that's where the instinct, instead of being the creative part, is the reigning in part.
So. But just that the fact that he has instinct at all, there's something hypocritical about what Socrates is doing in that he relies on instinct, but also that because his instinct is merely negative, he's just a shrunken human being.
So he says, in fact, this is at the very end of 15, Socrates is the archetype of the theoretical optimist whose belief that the nature of things can be discovered leads him to attribute to knowledge and understanding the power of a panacea, and who understands error to be inherently evil. At the end, to anyone in this state of mind, Plato's Socrates seems to be the teacher of a quite new form of Greek serenity and bliss existence, one which seeks to discharge itself in actions and mostly achieves this discharge by having a myometic and educative effect on noble youths in the hope of eventually fathering a genius.
And then right after that, but science, spurred by its powerful illusion, speeds irresistibly towards its limits, where its optimism, concealed in the essence of logic, suffers shipwreck.
Yeah. Maybe what Nietzsche's doing is saying that the real terrible thing that's happened is the unchecked rise of Socratism in the form of natural science.
let's just call it scientism, not just natural science, but the fact that everything, that's the optimism, that we see all problems as fodder for science, and that science just plugging away will plumb the depths and, right, you know, make us, we can be scientifically program ourselves to be happy. We can conquer all the universe.
The way 15 is set up, though, like the first paragraph makes it seem like Socratism is not a problem, it's an opportunity. So he says, the influence of Socrates is spread over posterity like a shadow that keeps growing in the evening sun. Again, prompts a regeneration of art in the metaphysical broadest and profoundest sense, guarantees the infinity of art. This, in a way, it makes it look like this scientific impulse, which is overreaching, is actually a good thing and necessary because it sets up the next counter resistance in the next stage where you get another synthesis or the Dionysian rises again. You get this new higher level, you know, speaking of Hegelianism, higher level synthesis, not in this case between the Dionysian and the Apollinian, but between the artistic and the scientistic. Or,
well, the music making Socrates, right? And I guess at the end of 15, he just leaves this as a question. And we knock with emotions stirred at the gates of the present and the future. Will that transformation lead to ever new configurations of genius and especially of the music-making Socrates? Will the net of art, which is spread over existence, whether it goes under the name of science or of religion, be woven ever stronger and finer, or is it destined to be torn to shreds in the relentlessly barbaric turmoil known as the present?
So you would think that, a self-critical approach, which is basically what Socratism is, would eventually overcome its own over-intellectualism. That, I'm trying to solve every problem. You know, so one of the things he outlines in the later sections here is that he sees with Kant and Schopenhauer that they actually, through this critical method, through the Socratic method, you know, led to the tampering down of the optimism, that they were trying to solve everything. But instead, Kant ended up drawing a fine distinction, like, well, this is what you can know, but then there's all this other stuff, the thing in itself, that we just can't know anything about. And that's humbling.
Yeah. There's new material for your tragedy. There are new disappointments because science initially seems promising, a promising solution to everything, not just to practical problems, but to the meaning of life, to making life significant and worthwhile. It's only until you've experienced that disappointment that it's not going to do that for you, that you can get to this higher level synthesis. So Socratism, you know, if I'm reading this right, is really necessary if you want to get to the music-making Socrates of the gay science and Nietzsche's sort of idealized version of a synthesis between artist and scientist.
Or someone like Ricoeur, who rediscovers, is emphasizing our need for myth. And, well, how can we, as good Gadamer-influenced hermeneuticists, interpreters of texts, interpreters of artworks, interpreters of whatever, rediscover what we're missing by over-intellectualizing, by trying to apply the scientific method to everything, by ruling out the role of intuition and being self-critical enough to realize that there are gaps left in our lives from a purely thought-based approach.
You know, it's one of the interesting things that gets glossed over when talking about Plato's forms and stuff like that, is all of the myth-making and myth-speaking that goes on in the Platonic dialogues, often out of the mouth of Socrates.
Yep. Well, we can see this as a prelude. You know, I think if people listening to this then turn immediately to our On Truth and Lie episode, where he talks more about this relationship between the scientific desire for truth and sort of what the human being actually needs, and gives a neat little historical analysis of that. Or I think this adds a great extra dimension to our previous discussion on the master morality, slave morality thing, because where's master morality here? Well, that sounds like the Homeric, but we describe that as not carefree, do whatever you want, but as raising this image of greatness to keep a damper in some ways on these nasty impulses that threaten to pull society apart. So it's really that the Apollonian and the Dionysian are both aspects of the master morality, which was way more complicated, at least in this ancient Greek form, than he would let on when he's doing this different hermeneutic analysis of the situation for a different reason. And then, of course, the artistic Socrates, we had our gay science episode. So that right there, he goes more into the positive. What is it to do very difficult, strict, rational thinking, but in a gay, a light, musical way that, you know, acknowledges the importance of the unconscious and all the things that can't be so easily cognized. The way he actually continues, so apparently our translator here, Walter Kaufman, says that section 15 was supposed to be the end of the book. I don't know the whole story of like why he continued it, but that he later regretted writing the rest of it. And Kaufman says that it reads like a parody of Richard Wagner's own writing. Not that I would know, but just that he really got down on his goal with the rest of this. Well, he's shown where ancient Greece sort of lost its mojo. Now, for the rest of it, he wants to apply how can Germany gain back its mojo by not just going back. It has to, of course, continue forward along the dialectical chain. But he saw enough in his own culture, in Wagner himself, in that kind of music that he thought was pushing in the right direction. And we could have, you know, a more Dionysian-influenced set of artworks, whereas the kind of opera that he was objecting to certainly had gotten all shallow.
And then he comes to regret that. I mean, as we see both in the Gay Science and his attempted self-critique. So he sort of sees himself later on as being in the thralls of Romanticism, which is an overcorrection, and it's not properly the synthesis of the Dionysian and the Apollinian. It's sentimental bullshit. And it's also dangerous. You know, he's also thinking here, and he more explicitly talks about it in Gay Science, but German nationalism and the rise of those sentiments out of this sort of simultaneously self-glorifying and self-pitying type of art.
Right. If you glorify your own instincts, then that's not being sufficiently self-critical in many practical circumstances, so that you and your cohorts can then get caught up in some horrible bandwagon of an aesthetic or political or any other sort.
Yeah.
And this is exactly what I was trying to object to before, which reflects Nietzsche's own criticism in the later preface here of this work, that he sees why it didn't go over, that it was very esoteric and purposefully like, this is only for the cool people. And I know that doesn't sound that different from Zarathustra and other things that he wrote later, but it's the sort of arbitrariness of some of it that John was referring to that ends up, you know, the fact that he could be so in favor of this Wagner, ultimately sentiment-driven aesthetic slash life philosophy, and then decide, wait a second, that's actually all life despising. There's something horrible about this. You know, that just shows that he wasn't at this point, at least according to his own analysis, operating with a critical enough mind on a firm enough basis. So I don't like this mode that if you sort of followed the line of critique in here, that would maybe, again, I'm sort of putting myself in Euripides' place because I'm unfamiliar with Euripides and how Claude-like maybe his plays, in fact, are. I don't know, but I can imagine like, wow, I'm really trying to do well at my art and I'm very self-critical and try to improve in every way. And then you just say, well, you know, ultimately, you just don't get it. You're just uninspired. You wouldn't have to do all the self-criticism if you just had the mojo in the first place. I find that as an artist enormously a frustrating.
So just for the record, I'd like to point out a couple of things. First off, I read this book while I was on vacation in Mexico. So I'm at the beach, children running around, people enjoying cocktails. I was reading Nietzsche's Birth of Tragedy, Cambridge edition. Not that I'm asking for people to pity me. I'm just saying.
Oh, I thought you were saying that like it was a badge of honor.
No.
He called it a slog.
I read the whole thing.
So the slog parts at the end, yeah.
Well, there's some fun stuff in the slog part. There's so much in here about that requires knowledge about Greek language and Greek history and Greek stuff that I thought I learned when I went to school at Reed 20-some-odd years ago. But obviously, I didn't learn enough. I'm kind of sympathetic. I kind of like this. I like the idea that there's a sense of recognition and resignation about tragedy in life that no amount of reason or knowledge is going to overcome, that you have to ultimately just deal with the fact, you know what, some of us are smarter than others. Some of us are, you know, some of us have soul or are cool or whatever, which is not to say that there isn't the possibility for change or you can't go work on something. But I think this points to kind of a healthy acknowledgement of difference and of circumstance that I think is missing these days. I think there's an optimism. This is an American thing. So for our listeners who are in other countries where they don't experience this, I apologize. But there's this sort of relentless idea that technology is somehow limitless and it's going to ultimately be our salvation. It's also going to radically change. So you have the naysayers like Bostrom, not the naysayers, the prophets of doom, right? That the AI is going to come and overtake us. But this idea that you hear people saying, you know, software can do anything and that technology is going to liberate us and all this, it's just a substitute. It's the latest incarnation of Socratic faith in knowledge, that knowledge is limitless. We think of technology and science as being limitless. And the solution to this is not religion. So you talk about Dawkins and these guys where they're opposing science and religion or faith. It's like ultimately the limit of science and knowledge is not faith, it's ignorance. And that, as you see, is exactly what's happening right now. There's this tidal wave of ignorance that's manifesting itself in politics and society. And it's exactly, I think, in a certain weird way, that Nietzsche diagnosed the condition of this age. And that's me talking a couple beers in after having put enough time into this thing that I feel like I earned the right to wax, if not poetic, then at least. But I think there's something to this.
I mean, absolutely. Nietzsche is so applicable. His critique of culture, you know, you could write a book just simply applying to Nietzsche to American culture. And it's, you know, of course, it's been done a few times, including Alan Bloom's famous Closing of the American Mind. Well, I want to revisit that and think, you know, see if I think he got that right, but in the way he actually applies Nietzsche. But Nietzsche is a prophet. I mean, ironically, he's a prophet warning against some of the dangers of what we saw with German nationalism, the poisonous of it, and then what it led to during two world wars. But he's also a prophet of the way in which the attempt to find something meaningful to hang on to in life can lead to the kind of forms of ignorance that, you know, to use Seth's word, that grip a society. And in this way, I think there's actually a lot more in common between Socrates and Nietzsche than Nietzsche is admitting, because Socrates is also focused on exposing what he calls conceit of wisdom, including some of the opinions that society, and especially moral and ethical opinions that a society holds most dear. So you could use Nietzsche to attack popular ways, popular conceptions of what is ethical. And so, for instance, even with like a Dawkins, there's a tendency towards a kind of nihilism or quasi-religious solutions toward nihilism that manifests itself even in atheism. So Nietzsche was also, even though he's an atheist, a critic of the kind of atheism that becomes cultish in and of itself, which I think arguably New Atheism and people like Harris and Dawkins are, because the important thing is not whether you're asserting the existence of God, but whether you think you have some totalizing solution to answer all of life's questions and so make it worth living. And the atheism of a Dawkins or Harris is just a mask for scientism, a mask for the idea that you can extend inquiry into these domains and then wrap them up. So even though you don't get God, you still get a set of answers.
Dylan, any more comments? Probably an extended 10-minute jag about philosophy of science would be perfect right now.
Well, I was thinking about physics earlier, and no. For me, the enduring image is of the music-making or the dancing Socrates, which Nietzsche turns to at the end and points to Socrates as having a transition in an epiphany of his life at the end, as told by Plato. But I think if you have any sensitivity at all, you'll see that spirit of Socrates all throughout most of the Platonic dialogues. I think that that spirit, live spirit of radical inquiry that is rooted in a kind of Dionysic, amorphous world that's richer than the reason that you can bring upon it, lives there as well. And that kind of end of this book, as rich as it is, that goes into the gay science and other things, is what I find most compelling and interesting.
Yep. My strategy for reading Nietzsche in general has been the one of the sage that alters his message depending on what he thinks the audience needs to hear or he comes up with different doctrines for different purposes to make a different point. He's a rhetorician in many ways. And so I don't take, and this is a topic for a different discussion, of course, you know, his talk of eternal recurrence or of the will to power as being literal metaphysical principles in the way that things like that are for Schopenhauer. And so I found it very interesting in here. So I don't have any problem with him like dissing Socrates in one place and being all, yay, Socrates. But of course, Socrates was great for history in another. But like, that's all. It's just how you read Nietzsche is by kind of sort of putting together all these different things he says in different places to get toward a general, not a set of doctrines, but a way of approaching problems and a way of being. So to see him in this early work where he was more firmly under the spell of a specific couple of figures, in particular Schopenhauer, you know, when we had just read him and how adamant he is about all of his opinions and that he does not rhetorically change his stance based on what point he's trying to prove. He's just like, I told you what I meant here. Maybe I'll say more about it to apply it to a different thing, to elaborate a little bit. But he's a dogmatist in a very significant sense, in a way that Nietzsche definitely is not. So it was fun to unpack that and see in this transitional work how maybe it is like John was saying, that we sort of see him a prisoner of these particular ways of thinking, but then also emerging from it at the same time. I wouldn't say it's that he gets better in that sense from section 1 to section 15 of the work or something, but this is definitely a transitional thing, and it's exciting for that reason. Hey, next time we're going to be talking to one of our old friends, Eva Brann, about her book Unwilling that came out in 2014. And Dylan's going to be there in person. It's going to be a lot of fun. We are supported by your donations. Please go to partialexaminedlife.com to make a contribution. Folks should come to the after show for this episode. It'll be on Sunday, July 26th at 3 p.m. Eastern Time, noon Pacific. Go sign up at partialexaminedlife.com. You have to be a citizen to attend, but anybody can watch. We've got a Facebook group. We've got a Twitter account. We've got all this stuff. All right. Thanks, guys. Good night, everybody.
Good night.
Good night. Good night.
I feel okay. I can barely recall that I've passed away. I guess it's just something you get used to. I'm here alone and I still love you. That was some act, I assure you. I feel weak, but I don't want to forget. I can't speak to you, I'm not dead yet. I know I told you I would never get over it. The last word is what you get. That was some act indeed. Showing you what I mean. Though it's asking a lot, I control it. God, I will carry this through my belonging to you. You never wanted to leave me like this. I catch you.